I'd like to say hello, Penny, and I thank you for getting in touch with Green and Women Everywhere. I'm slightly curious now how women get to hear about the archive, but also maybe you'd like to just say a little bit about your personal life background around, like, were your family supportive? What part of country that you were living in when you were involved with Greenham, things like that? Anything you're prepared to share?
Okay, yeah. So I was living in Reading, and we came out to on night watch, basically, to Bluegate, because I spent a lot of time at Bluegate. But my personal circumstances at the time were a bit complicated. I had one small baby when the women first arrived at Greenham. He must have been about 6 months old. And then later, I had another child quite soon afterwards. So for the Embrace the Base action, I had my daughter in a snuggly on my chest. So she was a few months old. So I was a mother of two small children at that time, and actually living with my husband, who was very supportive. But then, as sometimes happens, and I'm sure Greenham was part of the backdrop for all of this, I fell in love with a woman, and she and I got together, and it took some time to sort out the marriage and everything else. But anyway, we got together, and we were together for a long time, and we spent a lot of time together at Greenham. On night watch, and also on actions like breaking into the base. And I spent 36 hours in a police cell for my sins. And I would say I was well supported by my family. And what was the other thing you asked? Sorry.
Just how you managed to, how did you come across hearing about the archive and offering your interview?
I think I got an email about it. Someone must have, another friend must have sent me an email or forwarded something on. But I was also, I mean, just recently, as you will know, there's been this celebratory march or walk from Cardiff to the campsite. So we made some placards and went out to meet women and printed off lots of song sheets. And so we went out there and greeted everyone and took part in some singing and talking to people, and also listening to some of the women who actually lived at camp and some of the women who lived in Newbury at that time. I now live in Newbury with my female partner, not the same one, of how long have we been together? 28 years. So
Oh wow!
Nice. So she came with me to Greenham recently.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So so it was right on your doorstep. Were you part of a peace group or in Reading or something?
Yes, we were sort of loosely connected with CND, but I went just before I moved to Reading. I lived in London and was part of the West Hampstead Women's group there. And we went to a conference, which was actually in Nottingham, which was about women and nuclear power. And that was really what got me started, because there were some very interesting women scientists there, and they were talking about all the alternatives to nuclear power and what the consequences were and nuclear waste and all. It was a real learning experience for me. So when I moved to Reading, I then sought out both women's groups and groups that were protesting against nuclear power. And then, of course, we had the whole Greenham thing. So I was already in a supportive kind of network of people, both men and women, in Reading, who were, because the men were quite supportive, actually. They used to, they used to look after children, and B, sometimes drive around the perimeter fence if we were inside inside the base. They would sort of be looking out for us and pick us up and that sort of thing. So yeah, they were generally, and I do always point out to people that the first march that arrived did have men and children, indeed, you know, as well as the women in that march. Because it's sometimes misreported that, I don't know whether you noted, but obviously the women were the significant factor. And in fact, we were, as a small group of women in Reading, we were planning to come out and do some keening, some wailing, when the march arrived. And we'd been practicing this together as a group. But in the end, because I had this tiny baby, I didn't actually go to the when the women arrived, but I was very much sort of part of that point in history, if you like, or you know, when those women arrived, and then all the subsequent actions after that. Yeah.
You said some. You came to do night watch as well. There was
yes.
on the rota for that. So you mainly were did that at Blue Gate.
Yes, Blue Gate was an interesting gate. It was quite tough, really, because you've got the. Well, you may well know. Perhaps you'll tell me in a minute what your involvement was. But you know, obviously, you've got the squaddies at your back there, and a small amount of space, and also the road, so you get sort of vigilantes and just people shouting stuff from cars, and it was quite hard. So we basically went out. We used to take food, but also just to allow the women to sleep, and also then increasingly there were early morning, what do you call them, bailiffs arriving, and the big muncher truck. And that was awful. I mean, I do find sometimes that Greenham is a bit over glamorized. I mean, it certainly was extremely tough for women who lived at that gate, and there were increasingly fewer of them as well. But we had a rota for night watch, and also a rota of women who, whilst they felt they couldn't go out on night watch or didn't want to, they would look after children the next day for those of us who did go and do the night watch. So yeah.
So you mentioned that there were increasingly few. I mean I spent most of my time at Blue Gate. Just to,
oh, did you?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, but I'm afraid I don't remember you, Penny.
No, I don't remember you either.
We all look so different, sorry. Anyway, don't we?
Well, exactly. Aging. You know, aging. Yeah.
I mean, from what I remember, the numbers really fell off once the missiles had left, and the support yes. really fell off. In fact, we lost our public visibility. The Quakers stopped us using the Friends Meeting House in Newbury.
Really?
I've got the letters in. I've got the letters. I've got the Blue Gate diaries, and I've got the letters.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, the Quakers carried on coming once a month on a Sunday morning to Blue Gate, but they wanted their building back, and they. So it's just like we did really lose numbers once the missiles had gone, or even the announcement. And you know, again, campaign with CND was a nuclear disarmament thing, but the word seemed to go out that there wasn't any need now for a peace camp. And so I wonder if that you're referring to the numbers dropping off after cruise, because it was still on your doorstep.
No, I wasn't really. I was thinking, I mean, one thing that happened that was significant, I think, and I've heard one woman who lost custody of her children talking about this, is that when somebody lost custody of their children and Greenham was cited as the reason, then that put off a lot of women, I think. And, you know, that was one factor that maybe the numbers went down. And also Blue was a tough gate. I mean, there were probably more women at other gates. And then there was another gate, was it Violet, just down the road that was started up. And there were a few women there, but again, very few. So and also when the bailiffs started coming and taking all the stuff, you know, it was really, well, you all know, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but you know, it was really tough to keep having to start putting up bits of plastic again and get some sort of shelter, and having lost all your your possessions. Although I do remember being there, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think if you had things actually attached to your body or on your body, they could be called personal possessions. So I remember, you know, tent pegs in the socks, and you know, cloaks of plastic, and grabbing anything you could to, you know, hold it to you so they couldn't take it. Do you remember that?
Yeah. And I'm not really in the business of correcting, because we've all got our own experiences, and that's
and
the
memories.
Point of the archive, really.
Yeah.
So especially being so local, I mean, one of the things that we had to deal with a lot was journalists and you know, local journalists,
yeah,
national journalists, international journalists. Did you have much experience of that, and how did you feel about the media representation?
Yes, I didn't like it, obviously, and I think sometimes what happened was, my experience was that the women who lived there permanently were very careful about hygiene, they were very careful about litter, they were very careful about you know, protecting the environment. But when you have these massive numbers coming from all over the country and all over the world, obviously that was more difficult. And then it was certainly more difficult, I think, for locals who found, you know, Tampax around, and you know, and so that then, you know, we had all the kind of dirty lesbian stuff, didn't we, and reported in the media. But I've got some interesting stuff. I was just looking, actually, before the interview. A friend of mine called Elizabeth, after an article was in the Daily Telegraph, and her mother sent it to her, and it was about, you know, antisocial behaviour, so-called, or whatever they called it. And what I've got is a copy of a letter that Elizabeth wrote to her mother, which is really interesting. She's a very good writer. And I ran a women's writing course in Reading at the time, and one of the things we talked about was Greenham, and so there was some poetry from that. And then I also performed with a political poetry group called the Bloody Poets, and there were two women and three men in this group, and I wrote a rather silly poem called Herrings Are Radioactive, Mum, and so there were things, you know, written things, and I've got lots of, you probably have as well, you know, clippings from national or local press. And also I was involved in Reading group put out a kind of Greenham newsletter, which wasn't from the camp, but it was from, you know, it was about night watching, it was about people's experience of being there. And I've got lots of short pieces of writing about women cutting the fence, and some of those are amazing. So yes, I've got all this material. I mean, I've also got, because I must have been involved, I think I was involved in typing up or distributing the newsletter. And so I've got a list of people's names and addresses in Reading, mostly out of date now, but that I think I must shred because of data protection. But I've still got the little bits of writing, which are very moving, and also some of the newsletters that, you know, that we produced at the time. But yeah, the local, I didn't realize actually until I was listening to a talk at this recent meeting at Greenham when the women marched from Cardiff, one of the talks. And also they had some posters of local newspaper articles at the time. And I didn't realize there was this whole movement. I can't remember what it was called, but it was
Rage.
Rage, that was it, Rage. You know, because I lived in Reading, I didn't live in Newbury, so I wasn't so involved in that, but I wasn't actually aware of this whole Rage thing until just recently. But yeah, so that was terrible.
Yeah. So you had these little children. Did you take your children to Greenham at all?
Yes, I did. But I was, as I say, I had on my body in a snuggly thing for the Embrace the Base event. And then I think a couple of times probably I took them out there to take, when we were going out during the day to take food. I was quite wary about having them there. I think I certainly wouldn't have taken them there overnight, although I know children did live there. But I think because we were, you know, because we're involved in Blue Gate as well, I didn't feel appropriate, you know, to do that. And luckily I had supportive friends and family who would look after the children for me. It's quite interesting now because, you know, they're very proud and they're very interested in the whole. It's interesting looking back. I mean, I do wonder about how I spent my energy then and whether, you know, this is when I get into doubt, you know, and I start thinking, would it have been better to have been involved in, as I am now, periphery in the campaign against the arms trade? And also the environment, you know, which was fairly low on the agenda in those days. But I was always involved in politics, not in a political party, but in more active kind of politics. So going on demonstrations, I mean, we set up a rape crisis centre in Reading. I was involved in that. And then we campaigned about with women who were threatened with being deported. And so yeah, there were lots of things going on. I think my poor children were a bit neglected by their mother, if I'm honest, at this time, because I was so newly kind of fired up. I mean, I was in my 30s, mid-30s, and yeah, probably doing too much. I certainly wasn't a stay-at-home mum.
I will make a personal comment. It's just, yeah. I think it's really nice for kids to have more than one sort of mum or adults in their lives. You know, yes. We, as a feminist myself, we had an analysis around the nuclear family and how harmful it actually is for everybody involved, probably. Yeah. And that the privatisation of childcare was dumped on the mothers. We had supportive networks for mothers. You know, certainly lesbian mothers. I was very supportive of lesbian mothers when they were little, you know, and I could take them to nurseries and stuff. And there was there a peace centre or something in Reading?
No, there was a women's centre.
Women's centre.
And we used to have, we set up some shared childcare schemes. So, you know, there'd maybe be four of you with four kids, four little ones, little toddlers, and two could have, you know, a few hours off while the others took care of the other two took care of the four children. And the kids enjoyed it, and they liked seeing their little friends. And yeah, so that was one thing. And I was also involved in the lesbian mothers group, yeah, that met at that centre. I mean, that centre was amazing. It was really, it was really interesting. And it was also the way it was positioned. Sorry, this is not to do with Greenham, but it is, because the energy kind of came from this. But I just think it's interesting that where this women's centre was positioned in Reading, which was near the Abbey ruins, was a kind of right in the middle of a so-called witches triangle. So you've got the bloodstream, as it was called, the River Kennet, which actually comes from the Anglo-Saxon word cunt. And this is where women who were healers and midwives were drowned, you know, in these waters. But there were lots of, you know, and that's exactly where this centre was, right near this bloodstream. And I mean, I moved from London to Reading, and the energy, I mean, there was a first thing I went to, the conference I went to, there was a women in nuclear power group, there was a women in childbirth group, there were all these different groups already burgeoning or starting to emerge, just in this Reading, you know, this Reading centre. So there was a lot of female energy in Reading. I don't know if there still is, because I've lived away from it for such a long time now. And that, yeah. So that kind of supported the whole Greenham thing, I think. Yeah,
definitely, because it's a lot of court cases were in Reading as well, weren't they?
Yes, that's right. There
was a lot of support involved around that.
Yeah, because actually we were, that's where the centre was. It was in the basement of that, the old, it was the old Shire Hall, which then became the courts. So upstairs, there were women, you know, in the courts, and we were downstairs in the basement. We used to do all sorts of things, pregnancy testing kinds of things, probably terribly unsavory conditions, but anyway, it was brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. So I mean, one of the questions usually is like, how do you think Greenham changed your life? But obviously it changed it quite a lot. Have you got anything else to say about that?
Yes, it did. I mean, I when I went into the base the first time, it was on Nagasaki Day. And I really felt, I don't know if you've seen the film, there's a film that's come out called Mothers of the Revolution, I think it's called, and it's about Greenham, and it's the best thing I've seen on Greenham. And what it reminded me of was that we did this, you know, or some of us, you know, we did this as mothers. And in fact, the women who marched, you know, they were young mothers, a lot of them, the original women. And it was about trying to fundamentally change something for our children and for future generations. So, and I think it just made sense of a lot of things for me. It was part of a lot of things that I was involved in Greenham, but it was also the, in a much more sort of frivolous way, it was the backdrop of my first lesbian relationship, serious, and so it was terribly romantic. And the whole setting of it, and the smell of wood smoke in her hair, and you know, just all this stuff. And much poetry was written, most of which has been shredded. But, yes, all that sort of thing as well went on. But I think, yeah, it's it had an energy that was very important for women. And I remember one thing that was funny was because I started doing serious work. In the workplace, and I would be at conferences, you know, you'd be at business conferences, and there'd be women wearing a badge that said, "I'd rather be at Greenham." And I remember going to Bluegate one night, and a woman was wearing a badge, one of the women who lived there, that said, "I'd rather be down the pub." I thought that was so funny. So there was that, you know, there was this kind of glamorization of kind of it as well, as, you know, people who kind of, yeah, it was really important that people came to those big events, but it was also important to try and, it's like, where were they, you know, when the evictions were going on, and, you know, it was a lot of kind of, like, you know, people came once on a coach and it was all very jolly, and then,
yeah, I remember that, and then everyone goes and you're just surrounded by rubbish.
Yes, exactly.
Surrounded by the rubbish, and just like the whole post-party sort of thing of like, oh my god, now we're back here on our own. So you mentioned that you were in Newbury Nick for 36 hours. What had you done to deserve that then?
Well, just broken into the base, and unfortunately, because a lot of women were breaking in then, and they weren't getting arrested, so we weren't expecting to get arrested. And we cut through the fence, and we walked across. I mean, it was amazing. You know, we sort of walked across the runway and everything. And it was quite, if I do say so myself, it was quite brave. It was quite frightening because you didn't actually really know if someone was going to shoot you or. But well, the odd thing was, as you will know, is that you never saw an American. Very occasionally we'd see like a big American car swing out of the gates from them. But, you know, it was all fronted by the British military, which made me really angry. Although sometimes, you know, you could chat to these squaddies and they'd just be quite nice lads. But it was all, you know, and actually what happened was we got arrested. I mean, we were put in some little cabin thing. And I was really frightened. I felt quite claustrophobic. And then we got charged. And then we gave our address as Greenham Common Women, Bluegate Greenham Common Women's Camp. Well, of course, they, you know, only had to look at our hands to realise that we weren't living there. You know, we didn't look like, they knew the women who lived there, anyway. And so they didn't accept our address. So that's why, because it was a Saturday night, we had to then wait until the Monday morning. So we were all put in these cells until the Monday morning when the magistrates' court would open. And then I think we pleaded not guilty. I pleaded not guilty on the grounds that it was common land, blah, blah, blah. And I made a little statement about why I was there. And then they said, okay, we're going to fine you. I can't remember what the amount was. And then there was this terribly funny bit where the court usher or somebody said, where should we send these fines to? And somebody said, oh, Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp. So they then sent these fines to the camp, which we never saw or never paid or anything. So it was just, the whole thing was a bit ridiculous from that point of view. But yeah, and it was, but I mean, some women did a lot of prison. And, you know, we used to go and meet them when they came out of court or when they came out of, well, not so much, I didn't, when they came out of prison, but when they came out of court in Newbury and sing and weave and all these sorts of things that we did. So I mean, we could actually now, some of us sue the government for wrongful arrest, because that a bylaw was brought in illegally without due process. And I just thought it was outrageous that they could just come and slap these missiles down. And when another time, I mean, I was very naive as well, and I can remember going out once, and because we used to, well, that's the first thing we started doing actually, even before the night watches, we started following the launchers at different points in the countryside when they first started coming out on these practice runs. So just to prove that, you know, they couldn't come out securely without people knowing where they were and everything. And one time we had these, because there were no mobile phones, so we had these telephone trees. And, you know, we'd heard that the missile launcher was coming out at this particular time. And I think we must have known which gate, because anyway, it came out through Blue Gate. And I remember naively thinking, oh, well, what we'll do, you know, because we're all dancing in a circle and singing. And I thought, well, what we'll do, you know, when it comes out is the police will try to arrest us and we'll all lie limp and then drag us away. And what actually happened, I don't know where these police were, but just as the launcher was going to come out, suddenly, bang, I'm held up against a fence with a policeman's face like here. And they just pinned us. They just pinned us against the fences and let this launch come out. And I can remember this horrible sense of, I mean, I don't use this word, normally, because I don't really understand it. I don't really know what it means. But the closest I could come to describing that feeling of it and that sense of it was this evil, you know. It was a very, very dark experience, just standing there while this awful thing emerged, you know. And even now, I know, I mean, in a way, in some ways it's amazing, because I live in Greenham and lots of people walk their dogs there, and, you know, you can walk straight in through Blue Gate. It's really weird, but I really don't like it. I find it really creepy, the atmosphere of it, particularly near the silos. It's not actually a place it's still got that dark energy for me. Strange. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. You've described it really well. Thank you. I can see that where the poetry writing sort of comes in. You know, one of the motivations for some women were quite religious based. Did you have a religious, because you've talked quite a bit actually about energy, and that sort of more spiritual side of things was quite important, I think.
I mean, Greenham played a huge part actually in how I got involved in, well, I don't know, I would call it religion, but I got it. I'm very involved in Buddhism now, and I've been practicing Buddhist meditation and aspiring to follow the Buddhist path for about 35 years. And it started, this is a bit of a strange story, but I don't know if you knew a woman, she was at camp, and we were out there on night watch one night, and she was clearly quite disturbed and rambling, sitting around the fire and talking about, she thought that these people, these men were going to get her and they were going to beat her to death. And she apparently, we found later in talking with him at the camp, she was quite psychic, and she could sometimes see into the future in some way, if you believe in that sort of thing. I don't know, this was the story, but anyway, she was quite mentally disturbed, and she decided that she needed to get herself to the clinic in London, and she didn't have any money. I gave her 10 quid and put her on the bus to London. We accompanied her. And this was, we were kind of one of the last people to see her alive, basically, because she then was beaten to death on Denham Common in this horrendous thing. And before I knew that she died, I'd written this poem about her, and I thought her parents might like it. So I went to see her parents afterwards, and I was seriously interested in writing a book about her, her life, and, you know, because I was just fascinated in various elements of it. And so they told me that one of the places she used to go was Chithurst Buddhist Monastery in Sussex. So I went to Chithurst really to talk to them about, and I spoke to the abbot there, and he just remembered her. He did remember her because she used to, she didn't used to go along with the conventions there. She'd sort of eat at the wrong times and crash out in the shrine room and all sorts of things, because she basically wasn't well. But anyway, long story short, I kind of decided, there was a very funny energy around the whole thing, this idea of delving deeper. She'd also been involved in this funny cult, which her parents told us about, which was quite dark and strange. And I got some kind of negative, no, don't go there, sort of feeling about it. So I never wrote the book. But I did find Chithurst Buddhist Monastery. And I started going there because it was just such a wonderful place. And I started learning how to meditate. And then I went on Buddhist retreats at another monastery. And so ever since then, I've been seriously involved in Buddhism, and so have my children actually, and they both still practice. So Greenham and particularly were hugely instrumental in my picking up this religion.
Yeah, so you didn't arrive with religion, but you came away with it.
I came away with it, that's right.
And what did, I mean, you were back on the common this summer and you live really near it. I mean,
yes.
You've faced the legacy of the Women's Peace Camp and by the reclaiming of the common, but you still feel quite weird about it then.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I have been to the common a few times on, you know, with friends walking dogs or whatever. And also I took part in a really interesting but strange little theatrical group that put on I can't remember what they were called, but one of them was a, sorry, this is my energy guess. One of them was a, what do you call it? Worked with fabrics, was it, in a creative, artistic way. And the other one, I think, was a filmmaker and a dance. It was very much about dance. That's right. And they were looking for women locally who were interested in dance. And it was, they were going to be creating this piece about Greenham. And it was very abstract. And I was in a wheelchair at the time. So we kind of learned very, very quickly these dance moves. And we actually performed this piece. Jane was there. She came as well to see it. And we performed this piece on the runway, which is where Jane and I were arrested. So that was just incredible and very, very powerful. And it was a piece where the audience walked through the common and they were given earphones. It was a very small audience and then they would meet these various actors on their way on this walk. It was a bit weird, but it was really powerful as well. So that was fairly recent, must have been before lockdown. But otherwise, as I say, it's not my preferred choice of place to go for a walk because I don't like the silos and the creepy feel about some of it. But having said that, the arts base there is very good. And I've been to some an exhibition of sculpture there, and they do have some interesting arts things going on there. I don't know if I can, I've got this poem that is funny. Oh yeah, this is quite, I don't know if you can see this, but this is the poem that my husband, can you see that?
My husband did
the illustration.
Yeah.
Which is called Nuclear Family of the Future.
And yeah. Send that in. You can get a copy of that. Yeah. That's a really easy thing to put in as part of the interview. Now you're talking about it in the interview.
Yes. So I must have written this when I was still living in Northwest London, because on the back it's such a double-sided thing, and it's got, we're a group of women living in Northwest London. We're very concerned about the dangers now at every stage of the nuclear industry, blah blah blah. And contact West Hampstead Women's Group. But anyway, the poem, shall I read it?
That would be lovely.
It's really, it's not like other poetry that I've written, in that it's kind of doggerel, really, that I wrote for this bloody poets group. But it's called Herrings Are Radioactive, Dear. And it says, Mummy, why don't we ever have fish? Kippers are my favourite dish. Herrings are radioactive, dear. We've all got to wait for the levels to clear. Permitted levels are hard to find, but the papers say that we don't mind. Loyal British housewives, Thatcher said, have stood this country in good stead. When enemies threaten in time of strife, every man should turn to his wife. But she don't know nothing about living here with the windows closed and the constant fear. For the government will be safe and sound in their shelters underground. Who permits the safe levels, I want to know, because Eliza's got cancer and so has Joe. What's it all coming to? I don't know. Don't cry, Mummy, it won't last long. Mrs. Thatcher says we should all sing a song, a stiff upper lip and stay in the flats. Don't panic or leave like deserting rats. Mummy, I'm thirsty. Can I have a drink? Yes, but not the water from that sink. Boil it first and wash your hands. The goldfish died with scaly glands. Mummy, can I go out to play? Sorry, no, dear, not today. Could be a missile, so they say. The telly's off and the phone is dead, and your father's hiding under the bed. Mummy, can we go out to the park? No, the air is yellow, the sky is dark. There are piles of bodies on every street, and Mummy's too ill to get to her feet. Mummy, I'm frightened. Will we be okay? I don't want to stay here another day. I'm so afraid at the top of this tower. Mummy, why did those men make nuclear power? And that was my book at the time.
Oh, thank you for reading it and fishing it out. Wow.
Yeah, so because in Reading we were kind of between Aldermaston and Berkeley and Greenham, and there were lots of cases in the school of childhood cancer.
Oh.
At least one child died, and then another child had leukemia, and there was serious concern from some of the parents that this was to do with this local radiation. And I think although the poem, as I say, is really kind of doggerel and funny, but it's interesting, isn't it, that I just imagined this family of this woman and children living at the top of a tower, which you can now think of, you know, Grenfell and just these situations of people who are subject to whatever this government thinks is good enough, you know. And I wonder really where, sometimes in more depressed moments, you know, I wonder what's changed. I mean, in terms of feminism as well, and what little girls and young women growing up, you know, how they, what they have to come to terms with, what they have to cope with. But anyway, that's another whole story.
One of the things that I invite women to talk about is around the diversity, like, you know, the range of women that were involved with camp, and have you got anything to say about that?
I mean, it was quite interesting in terms of diversity at first, that, you know, you've got a lot of women who were mothers, who were married, and the gates were sort of quite different in a way. But then obviously in some ways it was easier for lesbians to be able to stay at camp than it was for women who were in relationships with men, I suppose. So you started getting more lesbians there. So there was diversity like that in terms of sexual orientation, but there were a lot, I would say there were a lot of gay, bisexual, whatever women there. There were young women. I mean, one of a woman I'm still friendly with now, I think she was 17 when she lived at Bluegate Kirsten, you might remember her, I don't know. So older, younger. I mean, I think it's fair to say that it was probably mostly white.
Thank you. Yeah. So have you anything else you want to add or comment?
No, I don't think so. Just, you know, thanks for this opportunity. And I used to keep diaries, and I had kind of suitcases full of them, you know, to write all the time. And then I got really worried about the children finding them, because it was really interesting, because they had lots of kind of historical stuff in and lots of detail about how I felt at the time. And I know that if people find their parents' diaries and they say anything, you know, I might have said, oh, the children are driving me mad, or Luke's having tantrums, but you know, that's the bit they remember. So it was very personal and very political at the same time. And I read all through them all, and then I shredded them one by one. This was a couple of years ago. I just shredded absolutely everything. And then I wrote a play, which was partly set at Greenham, called Moving Over, Moving On. And that was put on at Windsor Arts Centre. We had full house for two nights.
It was nice.
Very amateurish. I mean, I'd never written a play before in my life. You know, I had no kind of idea what I was doing, really. But anyway, we put this on. And so that was quite fun. And there's probably a copy of it somewhere, but I certainly shredded all of it, everything I thought. So there was lots about the marriage and about lesbianism and what men were responsible for. I was extremely angry in those days, very angry. I mean, that's just where the Buddhism's helped a lot, I think, is in making me more centered and more aware of my own mental states and, you know, how to work with the mind so that you're not acting out of anger, which is not really helpful. And it was wonderful the way you know, these women did operate with great kindness, actually, and you know, around peace rather than fighting. But also towards the end, you know, you had to fight, didn't you? You know, it was like, it's a mixture of things.
One of our chants I often remember is it was a wave all women's blues, women against violence against women. Yeah. And the chorus is, how can you be angry non-violently? Because it is a big challenge.
Right. Yes, it is. How to kind of channel that anger into something really positive, into positive action. And I'm reading a book at the moment, actually, which is by Thich Nhat Hanh. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a Buddhist teacher. He's quite elderly now. He's gone back to Vietnam. But anyway, he was very involved in anti-war, non-violent direct action in the times of the Vietnam War. And his latest book is called Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet. And it's just brilliant. And it's very much about, still about, you know, how you work with your own energies, and so that we can, you know, creatively try to prevent any further destruction. But yeah, it's a hard challenge, I think.
Yeah.
And also, I do remember that at one point, soon after the march first arrived, a decision was made, I think within a matter of possibly months, I can't remember, I may have got this wrong, but I do remember this point at which a decision was made that men would be asked to withdraw, or that they were saying that they would withdraw, and this decision was made, which was quite a difficult one. But part of it, I think, was because they thought it would be easier for women to avoid getting into violent situations with soldiers and the police, ha ha. But you know, it probably was true, and it was good that it's the more difficult for men, is what I'm trying to say, to take this peaceful path of non-violent action because of their conditioning and their male energy, you know, the testosterone and all the rest of it, and the whole way they've been brought up, they can much more easily, I think, get confrontation or caught in anger. I'm generalizing terribly about men, but you know what I mean.
There was a feminist analysis of anti-militarism being a masculinist politic, you know, sort of driven by masculinity, captured, you know, albeit like disproportionately. But I mean, yeah, I remember that. And but men were invited to continue their involvement from a supportive level.
Yes.
And I mean, you mentioned Cruise Watch, and men were quite involved with Cruise Watch.
Yes.
As I I understand it from other interviews, they agreed and were asked to not come within about 2 miles of the base because we had the walkie-talkies to connect. Right. Women living at camp would be, we monitored when it looked like they were lining up for the convoy to come out.
Yeah.
And then the telephone tree went into action, but and the walkie-talkies, so that we could, we did a call out with the cruise watch, and a lot of men that were supportive were involved with cruise watch.
Yeah. My former husband was one of those men, yeah. So
Oh, that's really nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is. And go and listen, look out for some names you might remember, and anyone you do want to get in touch with.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.